history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that might just raise your eyebrows if you take a little time to listen. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey each time, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories. And the stories you're going to hear today are some that I doubt you've ever heard before, unless you've picked up the book, The Smell of Kerosene, written by 87-year-old Don Malik of Lancaster, California. And this story goes back to the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, Neville Island. Tell everybody where Neville Island is.
Neville Island's about 11 miles to the northwest of Pittsburgh. The Ohio River turns up a little bit at Pittsburgh and goes to the west. And Neville Island was actually that. It was 7 miles long, half a mile wide at its widest. And many years ago, it was an Indian reservation. And then when it became settled, it became a garden spot for the city of Pittsburgh. They used to raise truck gardens down there. And then they would pull them by barge up to Pittsburgh. This is many years ago. But then, as they approached World War One, industry noticed it was a nice place to put some factories and things because of the shipping and the river. And so one half the island turned out to be industrial, but they kept it controlled where the other half was residential.
So you're a boy there, and you're thinking, you know, someday I'm going to be playing around with this unbelievable aircraft that's going to help us land on the moon someday. That's what you thought about as a kid, right?
No, not really. I tell you what, I think I was a pretty normal kid until about I was 11 years old and Pearl Harbor was attacked. And I was 11 years old. My older brother, I just had one brother, he was 17 and in high school. And we knew almost immediately that he was going to be in the service because World War II, a lot of people today aren't familiar with it, but it was really a national effort, a big mobilization of soldiers, sailors, and factories and something else. But I was aware of things about then, about war and fighting. And when my brother enlisted, he decided he wanted to fly, and he enlisted in the Army Air Corps, and he had always been my sort of hero and always looked up to him. So during the war, we followed him all the way through his training and through his missions over in England when he's flying bombers and things like that. And we were always crossing our fingers and praying that we were going to get him home because a lot of the boys didn't get home, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But he made it. He got back. So that was great. And then when I got out of high school, which was 48, the war ended in 1945, and I got out in 1948. So I went off to college. That was sort of a thing to do if you had the support and you were capable of it. I signed up and went to Penn State for a couple of years. Didn't graduate, but in 1950, June of 50, I had 2 years in, and I knew what the requirements were for flight training. I'd been tracking that all along because watching my brother go through all this and hearing all these stories when he came back home, I wanted to fly.
Was there a particular story or two that you still remember that your brother told you?
Well, he told me some pretty tough ones, too, and I think it sort of steals you, and maybe it would discourage some people, but they were shot down on one mission where they limped down into Belgium. They were hammered pretty good with flak. I don't think fighters got them, but they lost engines, and others were running rough, and they barely made it into an emergency field in Belgium, and that was sort of a spooky one, but the one that really hurt to hear it and hurt him to tell it was one of his classmates, a fellow named O'Brien, was flying a B-24 off on his right in formation on the bombing runs, and he just disappeared in a puff of smoke. They got hit with flak pretty heavy. I know that set my brother back a lot, and I thought about that too, and I thought, well, that was war, and I'm sorry it happened, but I'm glad my brother made it through and got back. So I think in a way to still want to get into flying and do flying was sort of a good base for me. Otherwise, when you're in the flying game, you lose a few people along the way. Training command and operations and everywhere, and it's something you just sort of have to accept. And you always say to yourself, well, that wouldn't be me. I'd avoid that. Well, sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. But I think stories like that were impressing me on just how important and demanding flying was.
Well, and I was struck by that in reading your book, guys that you describe as supremely talented pilots who you had great respect for, who died. And this wasn't in combat. This was in test operations, a very dangerous job that you carried out as well. But you mentioned your brother. It was Bob, right?
Yep.
Your book is dedicated to your brother.
I dedicated it to him because I got into the, well, because he was my idol and because all he had done in the war, and that was a primary reason. But I used to think of him when I was going through the Navy water survival training. And we used to say to each other, the Navy must think we're going to jump out of the airplane and have to swim all the way to shore and not get picked up by a ship or helicopter. They made it so tough to get through their training. And when I was a kid, small along the river, I hadn't learned to swim yet. I'm not sure how old I was. May have been six, seven, somewhere in there, but old enough to play along the river. So my brother was going to teach me to swim, and he helped me out from the shore to an area where there's a big boulder underwater where I could stand on that boulder and tread water in the current, because the Ohio River was always flowing, had a current. So then he went ashore, and he waved at me, time for me to learn to swim to shore. So I treaded water for a while there, and I finally decided he wasn't going to come out and get me, so I took off for shore, and I was splashing and kicking and doing everything in the world, but I made it to shore, and then I thought, well, I can swim. But when I got down to the Navy thing, I had to learn to swim again. They were even more demanding. But I thought at the time, he'd have been a good Navy instructor on swimming. Tough.
Yeah, it's a wonder you survived that moment with the strong current of the Ohio River.
Yeah.
And you describe in your book those days when your brother's off flying bombing missions in Europe and you're at home, and you paint a pretty powerful picture that I think communities across our country experience then that most people today don't know about. You talked about the blue stars hanging in the window.
Oh, yeah. Well, what it was, when you had a family service member, you would put a blue star in your window. If you happened to have two of them, you'd have two blue stars. And when people would look over to home, they'd say, well, they've got somebody in the service, somebody in the Army. And when they lost somebody, when somebody was killed in combat, that blue star would turn to gold. And I know we always said we don't want any gold star at our home. We want to stay blue. We sweat and prayed for that during the 4 years of the war.
Well, and that's, I usually am spending these times with guys who are fighting in that war. You weren't old enough to, but you're experiencing it. Your brother's life is in jeopardy there. And, I mean, I just imagine that as a young kid entering your teenage years, that it had to be a pretty sobering time.
It was. And what some of the things that we did, everybody was into the war effort. I think my dad was working 6 days a week. Some people worked 7 days a week. In the schools, they were selling what they call war stamps. And you get a book, and you could buy saving stamps. I don't know if they were 25 or 50 cents, but you could buy stamps if you had small change, which was to help the war effort. And when your book filled up, you could turn it in and get a war bond. And that was a big drive. They were really after money to support the war. And they had posters out everywhere. When I was a kid, I was old enough, I'd go and along the river where some of the companies were dumping slag and things, and we'd pick old pig iron up and junk metal to sell the junk man. He'd come through in a little truck. They wanted all the metal they could get for the war effort. And so people did that. Everybody was involved in that WW2. It was just something different. Some of the current combat wars or exposure we have, I sometimes feel sorry for the soldiers because sometimes they don't get enough recognition. They're doing the same thing the boys did in World War II, but much smaller scale.
So you decide that, just like your brother, you want to be a pilot. Did you have an idea of what kinds of planes you wanted to fly or what kind of flying you wanted to do?
Well, I had a general idea. My brother always told me he wanted to fly fighters, P-51s. But he didn't get assigned to them. They were looking for more bomber pilots than fighter pilots. So he always had that in the back of his mind or craw. So to me, fighter pilot was a goal. In 1950, I'd finished my second year of college. But the thing about it then was the Korean War had been getting hot. I think it had started before June of 50. It was ongoing. And they had the draft was still in place from World War II. They had never canceled the draft. And so as I come out of 2 years of college, I faced two things. I could go for the third year, junior year, and maybe get drafted because they were drafting out of colleges. Or I could sign up. And I had enough time, 2 years of college, to get into flight training. And so I decided right then, hey, no question now, that's where I'm going. I've always wanted to do that, and I've always wanted to get into flying, and there was the opportunity. So when I got home that June, I went up to Pittsburgh to a recruiting place, and I went into the, which was, I think it switched over to Air Force now, from Army Air Corps. I think the change had happened somewhere in there. But anyway, I went in to recruit, and a guy took down the early date, and he said, well, you're too young for our training, cadets. This was Air Force. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, 20 and a half is our minimum. And I was 19. I said, where's the Navy recruiter? He said, down the hall. So I walked down the Navy recruit because I knew they were taking them younger. I hadn't even thought about being a carrier pilot at that time or Navy, but I thought, well, I wanted to go into flying. That's what I'm doing.
And could you have possibly imagined the kind of machines that ultimately you'd be operating?
No, I think in a lot of professions, too, sometimes, and you go into it, and sometimes with young people, it's hard to convince them not to look too far ahead and too much about the big picture, but to do it in plateaus and work to it. And that's what happened to me. And I really wasn't. I wasn't going into flight training saying I'm going to be in test flying and do this or do that or test something that helps them go to the moon. Thing like I wanted to go in and fly, learn how to fly. And they taught me the Navy way. And I was a fighter pilot, so I learned to land on carriers. And I did a tour of 4 years. And when I was coming to release time in the Navy, I'd been married since I had my commission for about, well, we were married in 52. So about a year and a half or two, we'd been married, had a little girl, the oldest one, Sandra, and I talked to the wife, and the Navy duty and the carrier duty was sort of trying in that you'd go to sea for 6 months, 4 months, 9 months. We had one cruise. So you're in and out all the time away from home. At one time on a short cruise, my wife stayed in Jacksonville and kept the apartment, and she had a job with a phone company. But on a 9 month when she went home, she went on back home because that's a long time. So she stayed back in Pittsburgh with her folks and my folks. But we talked about it. And I said, I don't think I want to do the military career because there were fellows in my squadron who were senior, and they had teenagers in high school, and they were still doing this cruise bit. And so it was something you had to put up with if you wanted a military career in the Navy in that area. So I would come out. I went back to college and finished up Florida in engineering. I knew I wanted to fly, but I knew I had to have an engineering degree to get into that next plateau we're talking about, like test flying. And so I finished that up, and I was very fortunate. I came right out of college at Gainesville, June of 57. Uh-huh. And I found a job at Langley, NACA, and they had a couple of people in competition, and they evaluated everything, and I was fortunate. I got picked sort of the right time, the right place. And I went right from college, basic Navy flying, into NACA test flying. And of course, I was a junior test pilot, and I was in training with that group. Those are the senior pilots, older pilots, worked with you and brought you on into the test field.
And you say NACA, and most people don't know what that is because you were involved with NASA before it was NASA.
That's right. It was the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, and it was formed way back when. What happened, this country decided somewhere back in the early 20s that they needed to put some money into research, aeronautical research, because the countries in Europe were doing that. French and English, they were doing some testing and developing new flying machines. So they formed up a committee, National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, had a lot of senior aerodynamics and people with it in propulsion, and they formed up that center at Langley. It was always referred to as a mother center, was Langley, Virginia. And that's where I found the opening and went in the competition and got the job there. And they had a variety of things there. They had the helicopters I mentioned earlier, but they had some fighters, F-100s, 101s, and F-8s. And so it was a great place to go. And then they checked me out in some of the amphibians and multi engines that they used to run supplies back and forth to at Wallace Creek. So you got to the attitude or the mood that you could fly anything.
Well, and looking through your book, it sounds like you flew just about everything. And maybe let's start there before we get into some of the specific stories. Let me ask you just some dumb questions and see what kind of good answers you can come up with. So how many different aircraft do you think you've flown in your life?
I've tried to keep track of them, and my best estimate was 125 gliders, helicopters, and airplanes, different variety, fighters and bombers, but 125.
Helicopters, jets, lunar landers, everybody, you know, puts that trio together,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, quite a variety, yeah. I had over 11,000 flight hours.
What's the highest altitude you've ever gone to?
About 80,000. That was in the, I also flew SR-71s, Blackbirds, and that was the ones that we cruised at 80,000.
And we'll talk later about what it looks like from up there and what you can take in from there. So that's the highest you've been. What about the fastest? What's the top speed you've reached?
I did 3.2 Mach, which is about 2,200 miles an hour, and that was in the Blackbird. That was a cruise speed. That wasn't stressing anything or thing. You had to stop there because of heating, but that was the design speed of the propulsion system and the structure with 3.2 Mach.
I think we can all agree that is some serious speed. Don Malik was a NASA project test pilot for the SR-71 Blackbird and its predecessors, the YF-12 and the XB-70. His career from the early 50s to the late 80s spanned some incredible advances in aviation. He's written about it in his book, The Smell of Kerosene, which you can link to online at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this.